Please feel quite free to eat. That's another tradition of Thursday lectures. Bring your own food with you, as none is provided, but coffee is provided. Well, I hope that you've seen the cards for Tuesday, which is a big card, the original Jesus, and these green cards for Thursday. A number of mistakes on it, I'm afraid, including no name of the speaker, What Happened in Sodom. And that title, I think, will indicate the moral issue that we shall be studying during these 6 weeks, which is the matter of homosexual practice, which historically in our country and in the West has been called sodomy, obviously after the story in Genesis 19. Now, by way of preparation for Genesis 19, and I hope it won't irritate you that I'm not going to plunge straight into that, I'm going to look at two passages in chapter 18 by way of putting it in context. And just to put the verses right, because they're both wrong on the card, the first is called God's Soliloquy and is chapter 18, verse 16 to 21. And then next Thursday, there we may pick up on verses 20 and 21 again. It is basically chapter 18, verse 22 to the end, 33, if you like to correct your card. At any rate, you can put that in your notes if you're keeping them. Now, before I even plunge into this preparation to the study of chapter 19, I want to mention, by way of introduction, three things of which I am well aware. In case there should be anybody listening today or on the tape who doesn't think that the speaker is aware of these particular issues. First, I am well aware that most members of the gay Christian movement will easily dismiss what I'm going to say in these Bible studies. Some of you will know that in 1955, an extremely influential book called Homosexuality and the Christian Tradition was published by Longmans, and the author was a man called D. Sherwin Bailey. Derek Kidner, in a brilliant comment on the book in his Genesis commentary, says that the doubts Sherwin Bailey raised about the sin of Sodom have traveled more widely than the reasons he gives for his doubts, and that, in fact, none of his reasons bear any real scrutiny. Well, we shall come on to that in 3 weeks' time, as to what really was the sin of Sodom. But I think it's important for us to realize that in all liberal and radical churches today, it is assumed that Sodom has got nothing to do with impurity or unnatural sexual relationships. In other words, that book has caused people to think that the sin of Genesis 19 was a sin against hospitality and not a sin against someone's person. In any case, a leading clergyman connected with the GCM told me only recently that God is saying a new thing to the churches in our generation, as he is on many other things, and that as far as his experience went, he believed that love between two men was a God-given gift. Now, that means that whatever witness the Bible may give, and whatever tradition may say, and I think the Bible is very plain about it, and I'm quite sure tradition is very plain about it in the church over 2,000 years, it will make very little difference to people like that. And this particular man was a most sincere person, because he believes, as so many people in different parts of the church today believe, that the Spirit is leading us beyond the past, if you like, is cutting us off from our past, and is saying completely new things, and giving us completely new understandings. Well, I had coffee with this particular man, and he told me this was his view. And it was only really next day in the car as I was going along that suddenly the penny dropped and I realized that the reasoning I'd heard from him, and I suppose he would be a moderate Anglo-Catholic, was precisely the same reasoning that I hear from some of my more enthusiastic and perhaps extreme charismatic friends who care very little for history but who turn to what God is doing as they believe today and say, because this is happening, therefore it is right. And they claim the Holy Spirit's authority for what is happening. So I'm well aware in giving these Bible studies, which I think are of very great importance, because I think, as you do, that the Bible has something to say on these things, I'm aware that there are many members of the gay Christian movement who will dismiss these studies as really being irrelevant. However, I'm not entirely pessimistic, because the Bible has its own power, and the truly Christian soul is inevitably drawn to it. the conscience of man, if he is touched by the Spirit, will be touched by the Bible. And so that all real Christians who have been drawn into the GCM arena, and there are some real Christians who have been drawn into it, I have hopes that some of them at any rate will listen and not easily dismiss what the Scriptures say. Secondly, I'm well aware that there are some Christians who, if they hear these tape talks, may feel threatened. Now, all Christian people, and I'm sure this includes you who are sitting here today, know something of the bitterness of temptation. I've been in the ministry well over 30 years, and in the course of that time, Christian people have told me from time to time, sometimes with amazement, sometimes even with horror, of the quite appalling temptations that have been presented to them. For example, the temptation to commit suicide that every Christian knows is a sin. The temptation to act deceitfully, perhaps in a moment, in business, perhaps on some very big scale. Even the temptation to murder. It may seem horrifying to you, but if you know anything of the heart of men or your own heart, you will know that there are times when, perhaps due to the work of Satan, these temptations suddenly come to a man or a woman who may have been a Christian for many years. It's unrealistic not to acknowledge that. And no doubt sexual temptations of all kinds are amongst the most persistent and the most troublesome. So I am aware that if you talk about this, there are some Christians, perhaps fragile in this particular area of life, who begin to feel threatened immediately. And I want to say what I was taught at the age of 15 when first converted. Every young Christian ought to be taught it, and I guess you know it, and I hope you teach it. And that is that temptation is not sin. You cannot teach that to young Christians too early. You cannot emphasize it too plainly. Because when we are battered by temptations, when we're going through a down period, we feel fragile and unclean and condemned just because we're tempted so much. And it's very important for us to be aware and to teach, both for ourselves and for others, that the mark of the Christian life is not only blessing from God, but battle with Satan. Not only peace that passes all understanding, but war. That teaching which says that the heart of the Christian is marked only by perfect peace is totally unrealistic and totally unbiblical. So, I just want to say that by way of introduction to this series. I am well aware of the fact that Christians have gruesome temptations. Temptations, however, are not sin unless we surrender to them. Thirdly, I am well aware that certain practical questions of policy and behavior will not be specifically touched in these lectures, and some listeners may be disappointed. The fundamental purpose of Thursday lectures is not to give all the answers, even if I were capable of it, and I'm not, but to discover what the Bible actually says. That's the first priority, especially today, isn't it? In these days of biblical illiteracy. I was talking to a very fine Christian youth leader about a certain talk he heard at Greenbelt a week or two back, which was given very dogmatically and which contained many doubtful assertions. And he went up to one of the organizers of Greenbelt and he said, the trouble is that most of the youngsters here don't know when what they're hearing is wrong or right. Therefore, you've got to be more than careful what speakers you choose. Because we live in days of biblical illiteracy, even in the keenest churches. So what we're here to do on Thursdays is simply to get back to the foundations of the Bible, to look at the Old Testament and the New, and to see what it has to say about this unpleasant subject, but a subject that it is necessary for us to look at. And had it not been for the fact that it is necessary for me to look at it, for various reasons in this diocese, I don't think I would have studied chapter 19. It is just, isn't it, that these things we're driven to do so as we try to find out what the Bible really has to say. Well, now let's look then at this marvelous context in Genesis. Genesis 18:1 tells us that the Lord appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre. And you'll know that remarkable story. Some people have seen in the three men the Trinity, but I think it's safer to say that one was a divine figure and two were angels. You'll see that if you compare chapter 18, verse 22, where the men turned from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord. And in chapter 19, verse 1, the two angels came to Sodom. So there seems to be a distinction between two angels and some kind of divine figure. Now, obviously, God is spirit and no one has ever seen God. But there does seem to be here one of those marvelous anticipations of the incarnation that you get in the Old Testament. God making himself known to man in human form. You will know that at the beginning of chapter 18, Sarah has laughed and been rebuked. I never find it easy to blame her for laughing. And there must have been many other people who smiled when she turned up to the antenatal clinic at the local hospital when she looked so like a geriatric. And her laugh has been rebuked, as you know. And after that, we come into the story at verse 17. The Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Seeing that Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by him." No, for I have chosen him that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. Now, there is, of course, no intention of the biblical writer to suggest by these marvelous verses that there is any divine debate or hesitation in God's mind, no doubts as to what he's about to do. The purpose of this little soliloquy that we're allowed to overhear is to introduce us to the self-conscious purpose of God to disclose to Abraham what he's about to do. We may put the issue in two simple statements. Question, shall I hide it? Answer, no. That's what we've got in these two or three verses. Now, many of the things of God, as you well know, are hidden, and they remain so. Darkness has always covered God's throne, and our knowledge as Christians is severely limited. The fact that we do know wonderful things through the coming of Jesus Christ does not mean, of course, that we know everything. That famous verse at the end of Deuteronomy 29 has always been a favorite of mine. Let me read it to you. Deuteronomy 29:29. "The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the works of this law." And there the writer divides truth into two kinds, secret and revealed. Now, we rejoice on Tuesdays, don't we, in revealed truth. But there's a great deal of secret truth that we know nothing about and that God hasn't revealed. And the reason for that, of course, is that it's not necessary for us or for our children. In other words, it's not necessary for life as we have to live it here on earth. We shall know about it in the life of the world to come. Now, the delightful point is made in a number of commentaries that God discloses what he's going to do here because Abraham was known as God's friend. And if you want something for your notes there, Isaiah 41:8, and James 2:23. And in both those verses, one Old Testament, one New Testament, we have this delightful title given to Abraham, not only the father of the faithful, but the friend of God. And so it's very natural, as John 15:15 says, that I have not called you servants but friends, and I've made known to my friends my will, my truth. So it is a delightful thought that because Abraham is a friend of God, chosen by him, known by God, made God's friend, that God will disclose to him certain things that are important. Now, I've no doubt that that's true. But it doesn't really answer the question. The question is, why does God choose this moment to reveal this particular thing to his friend? And the answer to that, and this is the really important thing, it may not seem important as I say it now, but you'll come to see how important it is that God's purpose, according to these verses, is that Abraham should understand what is going to happen in Sodom and why it's going to happen. Let me repeat that. It's God's purpose to disclose to Abraham, his friend, so that Abraham should understand what will happen to Sodom and why. Now, see who Abraham is, according to verse 18. There are two marvelous titles here, or descriptions. Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation. What does that refer to? Obviously, it refers to the Jews, Israel. He was the father of the children of promise. And he became, indeed, a great and mighty nation then, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by him. And if you're a New Testament student, you'll know immediately what that phrase refers to. It refers, of course, to the dispersion of the truth to the nations of the world, which is the story of the Acts of the Apostles, so that Israel blossoms out into the universal church of today. All nations come to know God through Jesus Christ, and not just Israel. Now, of the Jews in the first place, Israel in the Old Testament, and now the universal church today, Abraham is the source, origin, or father. He is the beginning of it all. He's the father of the faithful throughout the world and to the end of time. Now, I don't need to say to you that Abraham has not in some proud way founded a brilliant dynasty because of his own gifts, but God in great mercy has come into what is paganism, you know the story, and chosen Abraham to be the beginning of this tremendous history of which we are part. So Abraham stands, of course, in the Bible as a very important figure, because it's there that God begins the whole story of faith and the making of a people to bear his name. Now, what is his duty? Well, look at verse 19. I have chosen him. He's going to be the source of this great nation going into all nations. I have chosen him that he may do what? Right from the beginning, as these great nations are formed, this great church is formed, I have chosen him that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord. That's what I've chosen him for. I've chosen him to teach these nations this truth. And that's amplified a bit by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. Now, there's such a wealth in there. I'm not going to go into it, but I do commend that to you who are Bible students, because you've got a very important balance here between grace and law. You will know all the arguments that there have been in evangelical biblical Christianity about the relationship of the two. Our calling is surely of grace, isn't it? But when we're called by the sovereign grace of God to follow Jesus Christ, it is that we may keep the way of the Lord and be obedient, isn't it? And that's the road that leads to blessing and the establishment of God's great and precious promises. In other words, God's promises for his church will not be fulfilled apart from the obedience of the church. That does not deny grace. It's grace that makes it possible for us to receive the commandments and obey them. So grace leads to obedience, and obedience leads to blessing, all that God blessed for his people. So then, God appears to Abraham because he desires that his children will always know the road that leads to the full enjoyment of his promises. Right from the start, right from the beginning, it's got to be plain. Now that's why this soliloquy, this divine soliloquy, is so important. It shows that what happened, or what is going to happen, at Sodom is intended to be part of God's revelation, not just for then, but for all time and for now. It's part of God's regular teaching program. The lesson of that judgment is for all generations. It's to be told to our children as well as their children, and to children's children. Now, the fact that Abraham did this, of course, is written into history, isn't it? Because, as you know, the Jewish race has a tremendously strong family tradition. Family relationships are still very precious to the Orthodox Jew. And in particular, homosexual relationships are taboo to a Jew. That is, at any rate, in theory, though, of course, that doesn't mean to say they necessarily always obey. But it's very much written into their traditions. You can't know something about Jewish traditions without realizing that Abraham did a good job. That the Old Testament is absolutely clear about it. But then similarly, you see, you find in the New Testament, and this is going to be our study right at the end of this course, you find in the New Testament that the event of Sodom is to have significance for all time as a warning. And let's look at just one example. We'll look at more later on. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 6. Just coming into the middle of the sentence, 2 Peter 2, verse 6, page 220 in the New Testament. If by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes he condemned them to extinction and made them an example to those who were to be ungodly, and so on. Do you see that language there? He made them to be an example. And I think it is worth going to the parallel verse, just over a few pages, Jude, with its one chapter, verse 7, on page 226, where again the same words are used. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise acted immorally and indulged in unnatural lust, serve as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. So, I want to say to you right at the beginning of this course that in verse 17 and 18 and 19 we have the mandate for a series like this. Most of us would prefer to dust this kind of subject under the carpet. Few of us want to soil our minds with this kind of thing. There are enough problems and temptations in the world without getting into this kind of thing. Nevertheless, we have here, you see, in 17 and 18 and 19, a very clear mandate. God says, I'm going to show Abraham these things that he may teach them. Therefore, he must understand them. Now, let's examine this a little bit more carefully in the light of verse 20 and 21. This is what the Lord said to Abraham. He said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry which has come to me, and if not, I will know. Now, I love those two verses. You see, it tells us something which is very important for us to know, that the outcry from the world and its sins goes up to God continually. I remember once preaching in Stockholm and being taken to the police headquarters, and there was an enormous wall, almost as big as the wall in front of me, which was all lit up. And in front of it, there was a long row of desks with police officers and others in front of it with machines, and all the evening little lights were popping up. This was a great map of Greater Stockholm. And so if there was a mugging reported over there, the light came up, and then a buzzer came, and the telephone was picked up, and the police knew what was going on. Of course, it was very limited, because they could only know the outcry that was reported to them. But as I stood there on the balcony watching it, I suppose Christians and preachers in particular have the occupational disease that they're always looking for illustrations. But I couldn't help seeing that as a picture of what is happening in heaven, isn't it? That everything that has happened throughout the whole world is known to God immediately. It's an awe-inspiring thought, isn't it? The outcry from every murder, every theft, every piece of injustice is immediately known in heaven. And of course God doesn't have to come down to see it and to check up. And yet there's something lovely in the condescension with which he uses the language of verse 21 in order to reassure Abraham, and we'll see more about this next week, that what he does is to weigh fully everything, all the evidence, so that he does perfect justice. I will come down to see if this outcry is correct, and if not, I will know. Of course he will know. Now you notice that all this is said to Abraham before there is any indication to the people living in Sodom and Gomorrah of the bolt from the blue that was coming to them so soon. Let me read from Calvin's commentary on Genesis from lectures in Geneva, 1554. Very clear. The Lord declares to his servant Abraham that Sodom was about to perish while it was yet entire and in the full enjoyment of its pleasures. Hence, no doubt remains that it did not perish by chance, but was subjected to divine punishment. That's a very important point, isn't it? You see, Christian revelation is made up of facts plus explanations. The facts by themselves are not enough. Lightning hits York Minster. And, what does it mean? Some Christians think it means that God is judging the Church of England because it appointed the Bishop of Durham. Some people don't. Now, I've got nothing to say on that at all because no one can know. It's impossible to know. Go on writing letters to the Church of England newspaper, it'll kingdom come. But no one can give you a definite answer, can they? It's simply something that happened, effect. But there's no interpretation. Now you see, the fact of the destruction of the cities of the plain, well, that happened historically. But that could have been a coincidence, couldn't it? And so most of the more liberal books on this, the sort of thing that I had to read when I was at college, make a great deal of this, you see. They point out that the Dead Sea coastal areas are rich today in deposits of sulfur and asphalt, that some kind of earthquake could have released gases like hydrogen sulfide. This would have ignited the asphalt and the petroleum. And von Red, who is a very distinguished commentator on Genesis, quotes a modern writer who says, "It would be easy for an entire mass of air over the open chasm to be suddenly in flame." So there is a crack in the earth, the gases come up, and the whole thing goes up. Now, I've no doubt that something like that is what happened. You see, therefore, I need to know, was it from God or not? It's perfectly easy to find a natural explanation of this catastrophe. But I need to know whether the language of chapter 19, verse 29 is right. Did God overthrow the cities of the plain, or was it simply a catastrophe such as happens from time to time? Now, that's one of the reasons predictive prophecy is given in the Bible. I don't want to stop on that, but you can see how important this is. One of the reasons from predictive prophecy is in order that God may make plain before it ever happens that it is going to happen, which is impossible for us to do, so that he may identify that this was not just a natural tragedy, but that his hand was behind it all. So, actually, this judgment stands out in the New Testament as the great example of God's anger towards privileged people who have given way to grave sin. And it's constantly alluded to. I hope you've got my point on this, you see. Jesus dying on a cross, a man hanging on a cross, there, historically, I won't go into all the details, by itself, it can't tell us anything, can it? Someone has got to tell us what that means. I've got to establish two things to have the Christian faith. I've got to establish the history of it, but I've got to establish that the interpretation that the apostles gave was the correct one. Otherwise, anyone can come along and reinterpret it, which is what the radical liberal theologians are doing today. You see, you wouldn't have known about Abraham. I've used this illustration before. If you were to go to a talk, those delightful lectures at the British Museum, for example, on the Middle Bronze Age, you would see slides put up by clever artists of wealthy people emigrating, you see, at that time from one country to another with their wife and children and animals and so on. And the lecturer would say, "Now there is a rich landowner emigrating. Do you see that picture?" And everybody would say, "Oh yeah, it's so interesting." But when that slide crosses the page of the Bible says, that's Abraham, the father of the faithful. Now, nobody can tell you that a rich landowner in the Middle Bronze Age is the father of the faithful except God. So you've got to have, you see, not only the facts, but the interpretation. That's why it's so important for us as Christians to say today that we stand by not just the facts, but that we stand by the biblical interpretation of the facts. Genesis chapter 13, verse 10 shows us what this land was like before the catastrophe. Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord. Well, look at our garden out here at the church. I've never seen the grass so green. Reason, it's been raining every day since the spring, isn't it? So we never had such green grass. Now, when Lot and Abraham decided to separate, they looked down, do you remember, and Lot saw this wonderful valley, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar, like the garden of the Lord. I love that description, a green and pleasant land. You hear people, don't you, singing Jerusalem, a green and pleasant land, as though this a green and pleasant land is our country. Well, yes, ours is a green and pleasant land. And like the Jordan Valley, it has been very greatly blessed by God for many hundreds of years. To our nation has been given very, very, very great privileges. Has there ever been a nation so privileged in the reception and knowledge of the gospel? Do you see, what this is telling us is, it doesn't matter how favored a valley was, how beautiful a Garden of Eden it was, God will turn it into dust and ashes. For certain reasons, and this is one of them. In other words, that there are reasons why, whatever your privileges, you cannot rest in them. And that's why the subject we're looking at during this time is so important, because it is one of the signs that God is judging men, and we'll come to that later when we look at the New Testament evidence. So then, to summarize, God comes to judge Sodom. That is what he is about to do. The reason, the great outcry that has come to heaven from earth, and the grave sin of which they are guilty. There are two ways, it seems to me, of neutralizing this particular story that we're going to study. The first way is the unspiritual way that I met constantly when I was at university reading theology, which is simply to deny that it means that. To refuse to believe that these stories have any real meaning of this kind, to refuse, in other words, to believe the biblical interpretation. That kind of negative, destructive criticism has been in the churches in the West now for 100 years, the way simply of unbelief. I think we're pretty used to that. I think in some ways, although it's done infinite harm and the harm will go on, I think in some ways that day is over. It has proved very obvious to people that that kind of Christianity doesn't produce any fruit, doesn't change any lives. But there's another way of invalidating and neutralizing divine revelation. That is not to deny it and attack it and destroy it, but to add to it by producing a new revelation. Now that seems to me to be much more sophisticated, much more contemporary, and much more dangerous to us. As this senior and very sincere clergyman said to me, God is revealing new things to the church today. And one of the things that he is revealing is that love between two people of the same sex, physically expressed, is God-given. Those were his very words to me. Now he's saying that that is a new revelation. Now do you see, a new revelation sincerely held as being the result of the guidance of the Spirit of God, coming in other words from those who claim to be believers in the guidance of the Spirit of God, is a very different thing from the old destructive criticism that I was brought up with. But it's just as dangerous. You can either destroy the revelation of this book by denying that it is revelation, you can also destroy it by saying there's a new revelation. And my dear friends, that comes very, very close to us at home as evangelical Christians. Because it is rife, is it not, in many evangelical, Pentecostal, and charismatic churches. Traditions of men are arising. I suppose they always have, haven't they? It's natural to us as men to look to get our own traditions. And these traditions of men come alongside the scriptures. And because they seem to be blessed by God, they get a certain authority, sanctity. And then we discover, do you see, that as we go along that road, as another generation takes up those traditions, what is actually happening is that the old authority is simply being neglected. The old revelation is being ignored. So today, that's very simple today, and you may be disappointed that we made so little progress, but I hope you'll agree with me that this initial divine soliloquy is both very moving and very important. For God comes down to his chosen Abraham, the father of the faithful, to declare what he is going to do in order that Abraham may charge his children, who will charge their children, so that for all time, the church may know what is God's mind on this very important issue.
Our gracious God, we thank you for the knowledge which is beyond our understanding, that there is no outcry on earth that is not heard in heaven. We thank you that divine judgment will in the end deal with every outcry and bring good out of every evil. And we thank you for the story as we begin our study of it today. and ask that we may be led wisely to handle the scriptures properly, and that what we receive from the scriptures we may believe, and what we may believe we may hold to and teach and practice. And we ask this for our own sake, and we ask it for our country's sake. We ask it indeed for Christ's sake. Amen.